Today is Monday, January 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Carol Van Damme in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, as Russia attacks Kyiv one half hour into the new year, Vladimir Putin meets with China's leader.
Putin called the partnership a stabilizing factor in an environment of increasing geopolitical tensions.
An American priest says it was courageous of former Pope Benedict XVI to step down in 2013.
I thought it was a very courageous and very, servant-oriented decision.
And a deadly stampede in Uganda. We'll have these stories and more next. More Russian missiles rocked Ukraine about 30 minutes into the new year. In a video address on New Year's Eve, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky condemned Russia's missile barrage in Ukraine.
Держава терорист не отримає прощення, а ті, хто віддає накази на такі удари, ті, хто здійснює.
He said today this Russian missile attack is not the end of the year, no matter how much the terrorists want it. It's the outcome of Russia's fate. Zelensky said the terrorist state will not be forgiven, and those who order such strikes and those who carry them out will not be pardoned. Zelensky also addressed the Russian people, saying, "Your leader wants to show that he has the troops behind him and that he's ahead, but he is just hiding. He hides behind the troops, behind missiles, behind the walls of his residences and palaces." Many of the drones and rocket attacks targeted the Ukrainian capital. Kyiv's mayor said there was no immediate word on casualties. In his own New Year's video message broadcast on Russian state TV, Putin said Russia was fighting in Ukraine to protect its motherland and to secure true independence for its people. In a frontline village in eastern Ukraine, from which remaining residents have been urged to leave, two farmers say they won't abandon their animals. Reuters correspondent Ed Barron reports.
Here in Yampil, a frontline village in east Ukraine, recaptured by Ukrainian forces at the end of September, after months under Russian occupation, buildings lie in ruins. Most people have left, but not farmers Yevhenia and Ivan, who say they could not bear to abandon their rabbits, ducks, chickens and pigeons.
We've always kept rabbits. When the missiles started falling down, I saw 15 of them on the ground, blood coming from their noses. It's the toll of the stress.
Ukrainian authorities have come with leaflets urging remaining residents to leave. Yevhenia says she and Ivan aren't going anywhere.
We have been working with poultry since we were children. Since we lived with mother and went to school, we grew poultry since childhood. This love grew with us up until our older years. This is what we do, and we can't live without our chickens, our rabbits. So we try to do as much as we can physically manage.
Nearby in the village, a blasted stable strewn with animal bones is a monument to the dark fate of some animals in a war zone. Private owners had collected a menagerie of exotic and wild animals there. Residents say the animals died, ran away, or were killed during the months of Russian occupation.
That's Ed Barron of Reuters reporting. Russia and China have vowed to deepen their bilateral cooperation against Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Associated Press correspondent Karen Chamas has more.
Russian President Vladimir Putin and Chinese leader Xi Jinping made no reference to the war in Ukraine as they held bilateral talks via video conference. But Putin called the partnership a stabilizing factor in an environment of increasing geopolitical tensions. Overnight, Russia attacked Ukraine with Iranian-made kamikaze drones, all of which were shot down, according to Ukraine's Air Force. Kyiv's mayor said many of the drones targeted the capital. The attack follows a barrage of missiles and airstrikes on Ukrainian targets from Russian forces over a 24-hour period. I'm Karen Chamas.
That is Pope Francis speaking in Italian at a Vespers service for the new year in which he praises the late Pope Benedict for his kindness. The funeral of Benedict XVI will be held on Thursday morning and will be presided over by Pope Francis, evidently, according to a statement by Vatican spokesman Matteo Bruni, who delivered what he called the sad news of Benedict's death in a short statement on Saturday morning. We get more on the former pontiff's legacy from Associated Press religion editor Walter Ratliff.
Pope Benedict XVI's seven-year tenure as spiritual leader of the world's 1.2 billion Roman Catholics was marked by controversy and reform. He also had the challenge of replacing the much-beloved Pope John Paul II. Benedict was born Joseph Ratzinger in Bavaria, Germany on Holy Saturday, 1927. At age 14, he was conscripted into the Hitler Youth, as were all children his age in Nazi Germany. After World War II, he studied to become a priest, spending three decades near the top of the church hierarchy. Benedict was elected pope in 2005 after John Paul's passing. From the onset, Benedict's papacy promoted a conservative agenda on abortion, euthanasia, and priest celibacy. Although he led the Catholic Church's foray into social media, Benedict may be remembered most for his stance on sexual abuse by priests. It was the leading issue during his tenure.
We are deeply ashamed, and we will do all the possible that this cannot happen in future.
He defrocked nearly 400 priests over 2 years for sexually molesting children. And for the first time, the Vatican issued explicit written guidelines telling bishops to report abuse to police. The Pope also held tearful meetings with victims to offer solace. His tenure was not without missteps. Just a year into his papacy, Benedict angered the Muslim world by quoting from a medieval text. The text characterized some of the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad as evil and inhuman. He soon apologized for any offense and made a rare visit to Istanbul's Blue Mosque. 2 years later, on his way to Cameroon, the Pope declared that condoms were not Africa's answer to AIDS. Critics challenged Benedict's rationale in a region hit hard by the AIDS epidemic. He eventually said condoms could be used in limited circumstances. During Benedict's tenure, Latin American Catholics, once among the church's strongest base, left in droves to become evangelical Protestants. He challenged bishops from Mexico to Chile to stem the tide. Like the 264 popes before him, Benedict's chief aim was inspiring faith.
Young people in particular, I appeal to you, bear witness to your faith to the digital world.
He was the first pope to embrace new media as a tool of inspiration, launching a YouTube channel, an iPhone application, and a Facebook page. At age 85, citing his deteriorating health, Benedict resigned as head of the Roman Catholic Church in February 2013. He was the first pope in nearly six centuries to resign from the position. While he lacked his predecessor's flair, religious scholars say Benedict's legacy is as the first true 21st century pope, reaching out to the faithful in new ways while holding tight to tradition. Walter Ratliff, The Associated Press.
Benedict stunned the Roman Catholic world by becoming the first pope in nearly 600 years to resign. Now, Pope Francis will preside over the funeral of his predecessor. A pope's death usually sets in motion a complicated procedure to choose the next head of the Catholic Church, but Pope Francis succeeded Benedict when he stepped down in 2013. I asked Monsignor John Ensler, president and CEO of Catholic Charities in Washington, D.C., and a priest on weekends at St. Bartholomew's Church in Bethesda, Maryland, what he thought of Benedict's decision to retire.
I thought it was a very courageous and very, servant-oriented decision. You know, here's the Pope. For 600 years, basically, it has not happened. And he decides, for whatever reason, that it's time for him to step aside, let someone else take his place. I don't know the reasons, but I certainly respect and appreciate the goodness. I think of St. John the Baptist. You know, and he said of Jesus, he said basically, he must increase and I must decrease. And I think to some degree, I felt like this is what the Pope was saying. I've got to get out of the way here. Of the church. I love the church so much, but maybe not the right person health-wise otherwise right now. So I was just overwhelmingly impressed with that decision. Just unbelievably good decision, I think. Well, a servant-oriented decision. And I think it's turned well because Francis has been a great pope since.
And speaking of Pope Francis, were you ever in the company of either Pope Francis or Pope Benedict when they came to Washington?
Actually, both of them. Benedict came to Washington. I saw him when he was here. But Pope Francis actually came to Catholic Charities, where I work. It's my day job. If I work in the parish on the weekends. But basically, he was right here. He was in our chapel, right in front of our building. He walked to the front door of our building. And he went across the street to the King Library. And we had a big tent set up. And he greeted the people. It was an amazing thing. So that was a very special time for me to be right in his presence. But again, when Benedict was here earlier, Cardinal World arranged that. I saw him, but not so close.
Is there anything that you want to say about former Pope Benedict that I didn't specifically ask you that you think is important to mention?
When I think about Pope Benedict, I just think about the sacrifice, or the servant leadership. This is not normal for most people to say, I'm in charge, I get all the power, I get all the prestige, but I'm going to get out of the way. That wouldn't happen with most CEOs, wouldn't do that. Secular leaders wouldn't do that. It's a pretty amazing thing. It speaks to to the goodness of his heart. And frankly, his holiness, to say, what's best for the church? What's best for the church? Maybe right now I'm not the best for the church. I'm going to get out of the way. I think it's amazing. Just amazing.
That's Monsignor John Ensler, President and CEO of Catholic Charities in Washington, D.C. He was speaking with me from Washington. The U.N. General Assembly has asked the United Nations' highest judicial body to give its opinion on the legality of Israeli policies in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem. We get more from Associated Press correspondent Norman Hall.
The Assembly voted by a wide margin, but with over 50 countries abstaining, to send one of the world's longest-running and thorniest disputes to the International Court of Justice. While the court's rulings are not binding, they influence international opinion. Israel captured the West Bank and East Jerusalem and Gaza Strip in the 1967 Mideast War. The Palestinians seek all three areas for an independent state. Israel considers the West Bank to be disputed territory and has built dozens of settlements that are now home to roughly 500,000 Jewish settlers. It also has annexed East Jerusalem and considers the entire city to be its capital. I'm Norman Hall.
We are bringing women voices to the conversation on things that matter to the hearts and minds of women. From right here in the nation's capital to on the ground from all over the African continent. We hear your voices, our voices. Right here on VOA, on Wednesdays at 1900 UTC.
You're listening to VOA News. The Ugandan police are investigating a stampede that occurred at a New Year's Eve event in Kampala and resulted in the deaths of at least 9 people, including several children. Halma Athumani reports from Kampala, Uganda.
The deadly crash occurred outside the Freedom City Mall, which hosted an event marking the new year. According to police, at midnight, the master of ceremonies encouraged attendees to go outside and watch the fireworks display. Lucas Oyesigira is the deputy spokesman, Kampala Metropolitan Police.
After the display ended, the stampede ensued, resulting in the instant deaths of 5 people and injuries of several others. Emergency responders arrived on the scene and transported the injured individuals to the hospital, where 9 were confirmed dead.
Haji Chimera, whose 2 children died in the stampede, spoke to VOA by phone. He says the children, one had been promoted to grade 7 and the other to grade 6. He says their father had taken them to Freedom City. Millions of Ugandans joined the rest of the world to usher in 2023, the first time in the new year was being welcomed with large festivities after 2 years due to COVID-19. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva was inaugurated on Sunday in the Brazilian capital, Brasilia, in an elaborate ceremony that included a music festival and hundreds of thousands of supporters. But it did not include departing far-right President Jair Bolsonaro, who has fled to the southern U.S. state of Florida. Without Bolsonaro, there was no transferring of the presidential sash, an important symbol of a peaceful transition of power. Many Brazilians still remember the 21-year military dictatorship that ended in 1985. Bolsonaro is facing numerous investigations from his time in office. When he lost the presidential race in October, he refused to concede without certain conditions. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Abductions, torture, and rapes are on the rise in eastern Congo. Dozens of women and children, along with other civilians, have been killed by the M23 rebels in the regions, according to a new UN report. The 21-page document, based on interviews with more than 200 sources and in-person visits to Congo's North Kivu province, where the M23-controlled territory was published this past week. Associated Press West Africa correspondent Sam Mednick, who was in eastern Congo in September, tells me the conflict has been percolating for decades in eastern Congo.
The people I spoke to just said that the situation was dire, that it was getting worse by the day, that they were concerned at that point of continuing attacks between M23 rebels and a coalition of self-defense groups, as well as the government. And they were worried that the fighting was going to inch closer to Goma, which is the main town in North Kivu province. A few weeks after I left, M23 did take a major town, Rutshuru Center. It also, after that, a lot of displaced people who had recently returned from Uganda and had just recently set up in this displacement site, that was completely destroyed and all those people left as well. So the situation has continued to get worse as the months and as the weeks have gone on.
Now, the United Nations has said, too, that they have evidence that there's been more rapes and abductions. What has the UN said about that exactly? And have you kind of corroborated that with what you found there?
The UN just put out, their panel of experts put out a report. And some of it, the part about M23, was based on more than 230 interviews. Also, they said that they took trips to the area, to Rutshuru territory, to Goma, and they had documentary evidence, videos, photos, saying that there's rapes, abductions, summarily executions of civilians. And the people I spoke to, a lot of them corroborated much of that, saying that the rebels would go into cities and just indiscriminately shoot people. They felt like if they were living under M23, they had very limited freedom of movement. They were taxed if they wanted to access their farms, about $5. And they just said that they were living in fear.
Why is this happening right now in this part of Congo? What are they fighting over, these different rebel groups?
There has been fighting with more than 120 rebel groups for years and years. So this has been going on in eastern Congo for a long time. M23 resurfaced late last year in November. They almost did take the capital, Goma, about 10 years ago, and they were pushed back, but they've been largely dormant since about November, December 2021. It's unclear exactly what they want. I have spoken to them, and they have said that they want dialogue with the government and that they want peace. They also were upset that the government wasn't abiding by a peace agreement from years ago, from 2009. But it's unclear at this point exactly what they want. They just keep saying that they want dialogue with the government, that they're not necessarily getting that. And they accuse the government of attacking their people and attacking innocent civilians as well, according to what they say.
That's AP West Africa correspondent Sam Mednick. She was speaking to me from Dakar, Senegal. North Korea forged ahead with its missile program in 2022 and took steps toward resuming testing of nuclear bombs as world events, including the COVID pandemic and war, fractured the already tenuous international pressure against it. Grace Lee of Reuters reports.
North Korea forged ahead with its missile program in 2022 as world events like the pandemic and the war in Ukraine fractured international pressure against it. It acknowledged its first COVID-19 outbreak in May, prolonging border closures and blocking international engagement. But that did little to slow its weapons tests, and this past year may have provided the clearest evidence yet that North Korea sees itself as a permanent nuclear weapons power. For years, Pyongyang has been banned from nuclear tests or missile launches by the United Nations Security Council. But China and Russia vetoed a U.S.-led push to impose more U.N. sanctions on North Korea in May. That move publicly split the council for the first time since it started punishing Pyongyang in 2006. North Korea was busy in 2022. It resumed testing intercontinental ballistic missiles, rolled out a series of short-ranged missiles, and started preparations to reopen its shuttered nuclear test site. It also successfully launched the massive new Hwasong-17, which is believed to have the range to strike anywhere in the United States. One former U.S. diplomat told Reuters, quote, "We are in dangerous and uncharted territory when it comes to the North Korean threat," and says that the possibility of denuclearizing North Korea has all but disappeared. As North Korea opens up to trade and travel again, analysts say it will likely continue to side with China and Russia and be less concerned with engagement with the United States or South Korea. Heightened tensions are likely to continue if Pyongyang feels COVID is too big of a threat to return to the negotiating table. That would see even more weapons tests into 2023.
That is correspondent Grace Lee with Reuters. To all our VOA listeners, you now find International Edition back on our general website, voanews.com. There you'll find other great VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voanews.com, and thanks for listening. This has been VOA's International Edition. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our websites for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voaafrica.com and voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In a year-end press conference, Secretary of State Antony Blinken highlighted four of the most consequential areas of diplomatic success in 2022. First, he noted, the United States rallied the world to ensure that Russia's war on Ukraine is a strategic failure.
Since February 24th, we brought together dozens of allies and partners to promote security, economic and humanitarian support to the Ukrainian people, as they stand up for their country's democracy, its sovereignty, and its independence. Our collective support, including now an additional $1.85 billion in U.S. military assistance, has enabled Ukraine's fighters to go on the counteroffensive, liberating their people, retaking more of their territory.
Secondly, we accelerated strategic convergence with our allies and partners on the People's Republic of China, said Secretary Blinken.
Back in May, I set out our strategy to meet the challenge posed by the PRC, invest in the foundations of our strength at home, align with our partners and allies, compete with China so that we can defend our interests and realize our vision for the future.
Furthermore, the United States and its allies remain united in their commitment to preserve peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait and continue to raise concerns and take joint action in response to the PRC's human rights abuses in Xinjiang and Tibet and the erosion of freedom of speech and the press in Hong Kong. Third, the United States has mobilized coalitions to deliver solutions to food security, health, energy, and climate, and inclusive economic growth. Finally, we use the power of American diplomacy to advance peace and prevent and mitigate conflict, said Secretary Blinken.
Together with my counterparts from Israel, Morocco, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and Egypt, I took part in the historic Negev Summit to advance integration and normalization in the Middle East. We brokered a historic agreement between Israel and Lebanon to resolve their longstanding maritime boundary dispute. We supported African-led talks that led to the cessation of hostilities between Ethiopia and Tigrayan forces. We helped bring about a framework agreement to put Sudan back on the path toward civilian-led democracy. We helped secure and later extend a truce in the Yemen conflict.
Looking ahead to 2023, said Secretary Blinken, the United States and its partners will continue to work together to build a world that's free, open, secure, and prosperous.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.